Hello, this is Auntie Bee's Knees with your business report for the week of March 24th. Oil prices plunged last week after spiking upwards over the past few months as U.S. threats of war in Iraq became a hostile reality. Analysts had speculated that the onset of war would create either a sharp drop or increase in oil prices, depending on how successful U.S. forces were at securing Iraq's oil fields. The threat of Iraq sabotaging hundreds of oil wells by setting them on fire has so far been avoided. In 1991, Iraqi troops torched more than 700 wellheads in Kuwait. Teams of firefighters from the U.S., Canada, and eight other countries worked from April until November of that year to douse the flames with seawater pumped through Kuwait's empty oil pipelines. It took Kuwait more than 2 years and $50 billion to restore its oil output to pre-Gulf War levels. This time around, U.S. and British forces have been quick to secure many of Iraq's key oil fields, though questions still remain about northern fields near the city of Kirkuk. The swift takeover of the oil fields by American and British troops lends credence to the argument that this war is chiefly about securing oil interests. Iraqi crude exports, totaling 2 million barrels per day, are expected to slow or even stop as the war intensifies, but that might not impact prices as OPEC members have spare production capacity of 3 to 4 million barrels a day and have committed to keeping market prices stable. In fact, OPEC is contributing to the drop in oil prices as Saudi Arabia and other OPEC countries have been overproducing in recent weeks in anticipation of shortfalls in Iraqi oil production. The U.S. maintains that Iraq's oil wells will be essential to rebuilding the country and its economy. Nonetheless, numerous questions remain to be answered about how the U.S. plans to administer Iraq's vast oil wealth after the war. Iraq's fields and pipelines are badly run down after 12 years of U.N. economic sanctions, and improving Iraq's oil capacity could be a challenge after the war. Meanwhile, the dip in oil prices that began last week as the war started is expected to continue this week, with the result that gas prices at North American pumps will also fall in coming weeks. Prices could remain volatile, however, not just because of the war, but due to recent developments in Nigeria. Nearly 30% of Nigeria's 2.2 million barrels a day in oil production has been shut down as oil companies pull out of the country in the midst of election-related violence. The Nigerian unit of Shell announced Friday that it had shut 175,000 barrels a day of output. Total Fina Elf said Saturday that it had shut in 30,000 barrels a day and evacuated one of its facilities in the region. On Sunday, Chevron Texaco shut in 285 million cubic feet of natural gas per day. Last week, a Chevron Texaco contract worker was killed by stray bullets. The company pulled its workers from the Escravos oil terminal and offshore platforms on Sunday, airlifting workers to other parts of the country. Chevron also evacuated 1,600 people from nearby communities who had sought refuge in the Escravos terminal. Militants involved in Nigeria's political struggle tell a very different story from Chevron Texaco's PR. The Federated Niger Delta Ijaw communities accuse Chevron of giving one of its helicopters to the military to use in attacking. They also say the military is using Chevron's tank farm at Escravos as a base from which to attack. Chevron denies these allegations, but for these kinds of reasons, the Federated Niger Delta Ijaw communities have threatened to blow up Chevron Texaco, Shell, and Total Fina Elf facilities if military raids continue and the government ignores calls for electoral reforms before elections take place next month. The struggle between the Ijaw and its Ikiri people has drawn a massive response from the Nigerian military, which has beefed up security at oil installations in the Niger Delta. On Sunday, Nigerian forces announced that they had arrested 17 men on suspicion of involvement with a conspiracy to blow up 11 multinational oil installations in the area. Meanwhile, villagers in affected communities accused the armed forces of indiscriminately pouring gunfire into their towns, causing hundreds to flee their homes. Nigeria is a leading global oil producer and was the fifth largest source of U.S. oil imports in 2002. The disruptions come at a time when Iraq's oil exports are being interrupted by war, and Venezuela's oil industry has yet to return to normal levels of output after a two-month-long strike led by oil barons against their leftist president. What with the war in Iraq dominating American news coverage, there was little word last week about the 2004 U.S. budget pushed through Congress on Friday. Though Democrats pleaded for a halt to the budget process after the war began, Republican leaders in the House and Senate chose not to stop their march toward tax cuts and record deficits, pausing only to pass resolutions in support of the troops and the president. Republican leaders decided on Thursday to forgo all the allotted time for debating the budget, in effect forcing a final vote Friday morning. Democrats complained that Republicans were intent on getting the budget passed quickly so they could preserve Bush's plan for massive tax cuts before the government requests tens of billions of dollars to pay for the war and its aftermath. However, with President Bush and the muscle of the administration focused predominantly overseas, congressional Republicans have found themselves pushing a bold set of initiatives without the ready assistance of Republican leaders. As a result, several items that had been priorities for the Bush administration have been deferred or defeated. The administration backed off a plan to require Medicaid recipients to join a health maintenance organization to get a prescription drug benefit, and has made little effort on its proposals to change the Social Security system. After telling Congress this year that it would not support additional requests for domestic security spending, the administration dropped its fight last week and agreed to include billions of dollars more for police and surveillance in the supplemental appropriations request. Three Republicans joined Democrats to cut $100 billion from Bush's proposed tax cuts to pay for the war, and while the administration preserved the rest of its $726 billion tax cut, many of the votes were surprisingly close, forcing Republican leaders in both houses to scramble for a winning margin. The White House has also lost the hard-fought battle to drill for oil in the Alaskan Arctic Wildlife Refuge. The Senate narrowly rejected this resolution by 52 to 48 votes. The proposal was a key element in Bush's energy plan. Nonetheless, Republicans were able to capitalize on the conflict in Iraq as a tool of persuasion as they lined up support for budget resolutions within a seriously divided Republican Congress. House leaders pounded home the idea that now is not the time to embarrass the president by defeating his budget plan. Republican senators made the argument that wartime was not an appropriate occasion to bicker about taxes. Quote, "When our troops are over there fighting, we don't want partisan bickering to be what they see on television from back home. We want them to see our support, our total commitment, because if the economy sags, it's going to affect everyone over there fighting now," said Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson of Texas. The Congressional Budget Office recently estimated that Bush's budget policies will cost the U.S. government $2.7 trillion over the next decade, generating budget deficits every year and turning an $890 billion surplus into a $1.82 trillion deficit. The Bush administration is projecting record deficits of $304 billion this year and $307 billion next year. But hey, Bush has at least $1.4 billion coming in thanks to the war on Iraq. Last week, he ordered the U.S. Treasury Department to seize assets belonging to the Iraqi government, which had been frozen in U.S. bank accounts since 1990. The money in accounts held by 17 U.S. banks, including Citigroup, JPMorgan Chase, and American Express, will be transferred to an account in the New York Federal Reserve Bank. The $1.4 billion, along with $600 million frozen by Britain and 10 other countries, is supposed to be used to help defray the costs of rebuilding Iraq after the war. The U.S. Treasury has also launched a global hunt for an additional $6 billion in concealed accounts that they suspect Saddam Hussein and his associates obtained through kickbacks and oil sales banned under U.N. sanctions. And the U.S. has asked other countries to freeze their Iraqi assets so that they can be used to help with the rebuilding. One Treasury official noted that France and Switzerland are among the countries that have not frozen Iraqi funds. But according to the U.S. Patriot Act, countries that don't cooperate in this effort could be cut off from the U.S. financial system. Barring a country or its financial institutions from the U.S. system would entail cutting off corresponding bank accounts with U.S. banks that foreign banks use to deposit money and do business in the states. Once the U.S. has its billions in Iraqi booty, how will they spend it? The job of rebuilding Iraq after the war is shaping up as a windfall for U.S. military contractors. Money seized from Iraqi bank accounts will join the contributions of U.S. taxpayers to fill the coffers of the Defense Department's two-month-old Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance and of the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID. Iraq's oil export revenue, now administered by the United Nations, may also be tapped, but it's unclear whether these funds will remain under UN control and whether work will be offered to firms from around the world. Even companies from Britain and Australia, the other countries contributing ground combat troops to fight in Iraq, are being barred from major contracts in the U.S. plan to create a new and improved Iraq over the next couple of years. Canadian companies might have a shot at work paid for by international agencies or subcontracted from U.S. firms, but only U.S. firms are eligible to bid on most USAID activities. USAID is already in the midst of a secretive fast-track process to award 8 contracts worth billions of dollars to restore damaged infrastructure and services in Iraq and to undertake activities like brainwashing Iraqi children by overhauling Iraq's education system. Only U.S. companies have been invited to bid on these lucrative contracts. Working outside normal procurement rules, USAID has quietly asked at least 5 U.S. corporations to bid on the contracts. contracts, including water privatizer Bechtel Group and Vice President Dick Cheney's cronies at Halliburton. Halliburton, formerly run by Cheney, has already been chosen by the Pentagon to oversee efforts to fight oil well fires should Iraq's oil fields be set ablaze. It remains to be seen what lucky corporate power will win the much bigger job of repairing and upgrading the country's oil industry, including wells, pipelines, and refineries. Other contracts coming up for grabs will involve Air and Seaport Administration, warehousing, trucking, customs, and bottled water supplies, public health, and local government. And lastly, on a brighter note, the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, has finally admitted that its policy of forcing developing nations to open their markets up to foreign investment has simply augmented those countries' financial woes. In a report released last week, the IMF said, quote, "The process of capital account liberalization appears to have been accompanied in some cases by increased vulnerability to crises. If financial integration has a positive effect on growth, there is as yet no clear and robust empirical proof that the effect is quantitatively significant," end quote. The report prepared by IMF chief economist Kenneth Rogoff went on to warn countries to be cautious about integrating with the global economy. Instead, the report suggests that developing economies need to try and achieve a balance by creating strong domestic financial institutions. Argentina, Brazil, Indonesia, and Russia are among the countries that have followed the IMF's advice to open up to foreign investment in exchange for hundreds of billions of dollars in loans. In each case, as soon as there was a whiff of economic trouble in these countries, foreign investors pulled their capital out, plunging the economies into recession. The U.S. is the largest shareholder in the IMF and has been instrumental in shaping its free market policies. That's a wrap for this week's Business Report. Signing off, this is Auntie Bee's Knees, reminding you to put your money where your mouth is and invest ethically.